Welcome to Syntropic World. I hope to take you on an adventure of possibility about a world that is syntropic, where all we do as humans in universe leaves everything better. Thank you to my wonderful guests, people I admire, people who make me better. Special thanks to Foundation Nova Diem for producing this series. If you are a social enterprise seeking an avenue for digital storytelling, I cannot recommend Nova Diem enough. Now let's get started. Thank you for listening. I am thrilled to introduce my wonderful guest today, Cindy Ford. Cindy has become one of my greatest friends and most beloved friends. She is a force of nature and an inspiration to me. I could read out her bio. She's a multi-award winning, shared stages with big names like David Attenborough. An incredible book, Bright New World, that has found its way onto the Australian National Curriculum of Education. But for me, at the personal level, Cindy is someone who stands for injustice, so stands against injustice, stands for justice, stands fiercely and strongly for the rights of all humans to be seen, heard, and recognized. She backs herself around this. You know, back in the day, she was part of the anti-apartheid movement in London and found herself in court. That type of spirited, embodied, inspirational activism. And every time I spend time with Cindy, I am a better human for that experience. So thank you, Cindy, for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, Christine. It's just such a pleasure to be here. And I know the feelings are entirely reciprocated. I think your vision, your work, the light that you bring to us all with that is a force of nature and a force of change, the force we need to tap into to turn our trajectory towards a much brighter future for all of us.
Thank you. So you are writing a new book, and it is about colonization and climate change. I have had the privilege of reading the summary that goes to editors and so on. Can you speak, and it was such a profound experience for me reading that I was moved to tears multiple times. I learned things that I never imagined, and yeah, it was gorgeous writing and just a beautiful, beautiful outline for this book. So can you speak a little bit about white Wessico, the Molochian system, the spell our Western world is under, and which is part of what you're covering in this work that you're exploring at the moment?
Yeah, I think very recently a friend shared with me a video, which I shared with you, of Dr. Leila June, when she speaks about how it's called How Humans Can Regenerate Earth. And at first I just thought, gosh, this is a stretch. But when you watch this, or when you think about it, it's actually a memory for the first 97% of our very short 300,000 years on this 4.6 billion year old planet. We did live in balance with nature. I mean, some peoples, we know more about some peoples than others, but we do have an awful lot of knowledge about how people lived. You've got the eyewitnesses' accounts of the people who went to settle or to ravage the North and South America. We've got the indigenous people who are, the same for Australia. You've got the indigenous people who are still living in this, in a practice, a relationship with Earth, where you regenerate, where you are an anchor ecosystem species. You leave everything better than you found it because your livelihood depends on that. You need to make your forest gardens, the gardens flourish, that the species around you be abundant because you draw your own livelihood from that. And I'm not saying we need to live in this, go back and live in the forest. That's not going to suit everybody. We have amazing technology. We have all sorts we have a different way of being now, but it is entirely possible for our relationship with Earth to hold that in the spirit and to be regenerative. And so it was for such a long time that we lived like that. And when the First Nations people saw that, what the settler in you know, people were doing, the colonizers were doing. They simply could not believe it. They were terraforming Earth. They were ripping out the forest. They were ripping out the life support systems. They would actually, that was a deliberate practice, ecocide as a form of genocide, because they knew that if they destroyed the forest, they did know that that's the First Nations people drew their life from the forest. So that was, they were destroying them. And so the First Nations people could not compute that a creature would do this to its own environment. And they began to understand this in terms of wetiko. The only way they could begin to understand what was happening was by seeing it as wetiko, a deeply infectious psychological disease, which is fueled by greed and power. And it's such a, you know, it's such a brilliant encapsulation of what's happening now. And they knew that would destroy their world. They could see it spreading across North America. They knew that would destroy the world that they had, and foretold that it would destroy, it wouldn't stop, the spread would go out, and it would take over planet Earth. I mean, it was already happening in different parts of our planet. So I think it is a very, I don't want to speak in pejorative terms about so much of humanity, but so that disease is highly infectious. Almost everybody, not everybody, some people seem to have a, you know, an innate spiritual resistance to it, but so many of us are caught up into this belief that that's how we have to act now. We have to colonize everything, take as much as we can get, train our children and pump them through so that they can come out as the dominators. You know, that success looks like for us, taking as much as you possibly can without even thinking of what you're going to give back. And you can see that from the micro to the macro of our leadership. That's the worst place where it's embedded, is a leadership that is based on, we now have, you know, our measure of success is GDP, which in a way is its own slave master. It shackles countries to this endless cycle of growth. So everything has to be thrown into this maw, this furnace, to enable that to happen. And it has really, I think some of it has been entirely intentional. People set out to colonize, to take as much resource as they could, you know, from a colonized place to create wealth for the home country. But I also think there's something that has just, it is, like you say, a Moloch, that everything that we've designed by it's like you're setting a pattern in motion, and it's taken on almost a life of its own, this ghastly, the purpose of existence is to extract to extinction. And I think it's very hard for us to stop this thing that is now in motion, because it is becoming all consuming. So being conscious of it is hugely important, because then we know how and where we need to act to, you know, if we're going to have a chance to put the brake on this thing, to, you know, it is recognizing what is going on at that cellular level, so that we can maybe re-engineer ourselves, reprogram ourselves spiritually, reset ourselves spiritually, so that we live by a different set of principles which guide us back to this regenerative place that we started, and away from this total destruction.
Yeah, it is really like the fish that can't see water, that story, which we've all had experiences of that to some degree, where you wake up and you realize that you're missing whole segments or pieces of information. And really, once we can see what wasn't present, then we have a choice of how we respond to that. But when we're caught in not seeing it and not knowing that we're on this giant super organism treadmill beast, there's nothing, we're just responding. Where it's almost like a reactionary response to what the beast is doing. And so, you know, that first recognition is really, really important, because only then can we do something else. And so you've been part of the work of Syntropic World since before it was called Syntropic World. We met about 10 years ago now, I think, but anyway, and you've been an integral part of the formation of this through our friendship and dialogue and support and so on. So when you think about that Molochian wetiko type of existence, why is it that you have a strong sense, and I can speak to this clearly, but why do you have a strong sense that things like some of the things that we're working on in Centropic Worlds could be a new map, model, mindset, way of being that is not reanimating the very same ingredients that creates that Molochian dominating superiority, exploitative, extractive, colonizing impulse?
Well, I think it is, you know, it's just a really powerful way that we can recognize what are, you know, the trajectory we're on. And also what I absolutely love about syntropic thinking is it gives you the tools to do the reset, is that, or to change the you know, to build the new model, as you always say. For me, it's reminiscent very much. I think I've spoken to you certainly about this before. I've seen fantastic Kate Raworth present on the donut economics, and she holds up that image of the solar system as, or the planetary system as Ptolemy believed it to be. So that's with the Earth at the center of the, you know, of the system. And she's, you know, she says economically, you know, that in if we're, well, I'll come back to that. Then next to the image of Ptolemy is Copernicus, who can see things completely differently. He knows that it's the Earth. It's the sun is the center of the solar system, and the Earth is one of the planets going around the sun. And it's been, for a long time, it's been very dangerous for him to say that, but he can see it very clearly, and he has to bide his time, though, to bring this idea and make it visible. But once he's made it visible, you know, there it is. It just takes off. And Kate speaks to that in the economic frame, because she's saying our current economic system, the death of Earth, where human-centric activity is and growing in these human terms of profit, the death of Earth, which for you, would you call it in your syntropic terms, a processional effect of this, is an economic externality. So the absolute bonkersness of what we're doing, this growth while we're killing ourselves, and that just those simple models, the looking at the planetary systems, the solar, the Kate's donut, and your syntropic, it invites us to do that really simple, almost blip of the way that we see the world. As you say, you can suddenly see that water that you're in. Your work, syntropic work, invites us to understand that everything that we need to do does need to be along the principles of universe. It does need to be regenerative. Otherwise, we are fueling our own demise and taking, you know, life on Earth as we understand it with us. So it's just such powerful work. And it's not only just a way that very quickly makes that apparent. It's also, so then what do we do about it? Because that's the worst thing, is that everything's gone wrong, it's all terrible. But, you know, you really work on the building, the construct, and the tools that you offer us are just astonishing, because they start with the relationships. It's not, let's do this, let's suck carbon out of the atmosphere, let's design an enterprise that's going to make lots of money, but doing good at the same time. It's like, how do we build the relationship, which is how every ecosystem really does work. Everything from the, you know, the cell's relationship with its next cell, that has to be grounded in the right kind of ecology for the relationship to flourish. And then you invite us to begin there. And I'm sure you'll hopefully talk about that. There's a whole other set of tools that build from that first relationship, that build an ecosystem that is robust, that is self-regenerating, and it goes out from that small micro to the macro. So you can really quite comfortably envisage how we could turn that with that simple trim tab reset.
You described that about what we do more beautifully than I've heard myself describe it. So thank you for that. So a couple of things that I would like to sort of respond there. The work of Centropic World is both at the systems level and at the ground level. At the systems level, and sometimes when I mention this to people, it's frankly, it can be terrifying, or they can think I'm an idealist or too naive. Bucky Fuller, my mentor, would say, dare to be naive. And I would say I'm a passionate idealist, because goodness knows we need them. But anyway, at the systems level, from my perspective, the things that are the container, the framework of the Molochian white wetiko superorganism type of world that we have are the existing tools, our economic system, our GDP growth, our finance system, monetary systems, capitalism, and how we account for value, how we work in the world and with the world and with nature, how we consider the future. So those large systems that can be terrifying to look at and scary and can go, no, they'll never end, but everything always changes. Yet the work is on the ground. It's right down to the simple level of language and words and relationship with each other, as you mentioned, which was so important, because one of the things that I believe is that bring humans together around an intention that they care deeply about for a world with a future for Earth and all her creatures, and create an ecology where they can be their best selves, then we can create the more beautiful world that our hearts know is possible. There's everything is there, all of the ingredients. But few people get the opportunity to really step into that place where they can bring their whole agency to a community, to a purpose that refuses to animate the structures of our current systems, our legal codes and so on. And that might sound really hard to people, but it's actually not that hard. It's just, we know that we need to do something different. And there are people around the world that are really applying these type of principles. So yeah, it really does start at the sort of the ground level and with the relationships, people, not just to humans, you know, it's the relationships as well with each other, but with the earth and the creatures. It's our connection and our being in partnership with life and holding the sacredness of life as central to pretty much everything that we do. And you and I have talked about this a lot, that my experience of many years of intimate conversations with people in high positions within the traditional system structure, I've reached a conclusion that the majority of people are genuinely good people who want to contribute to a better world for their children and for Earth and life itself. And yet, you know, again, fish and water can't see trapped in this system. So don't know what to do now with a question.
I do agree with you. Christine, it's almost like the tools that people have been given are so, you know, you're told you want to do your best. I want to do my best for my family and my children. So the way to do it is go out and grab as much as I can from everybody else and teach them. You know, I know it sounds, this is very crude, a very crude summation, but, you know, essentially our system from the conquistadores who went over to another, you know, territory, butchered everybody and brought back the gold. I mean, it's a, you know, that's extreme, is extreme violent, but in a way, metaphorically, the pattern is still there. You go out, Mother Teresa said, we have drawn the circle of our family too small. And with a globally connected world now, you can see that because you're told to go out and get as much in the tools that we're given to protect the family, or to get as much as you feel you need for your family or you want for your family. At stages of remove, it means that you've got to take it from somebody else. With colonization, it was as clear as a bell, because you went over to India or to Africa or to Australia. You extracted resources like hell from those places. You removed the people either to settle your own people there, or you put those people to work as slave labor or indentured labor for this resource extraction. You bought that back. You put the ugliness away across an ocean, and you lived Britain beautiful cities, which, you know, on the process of that wealth, and you sat there in your marvelous city and behaved very respectably in your home, but that was built off tremendous suffering for all these other people. And I think that is, and the people that, oh well, you know, we can put, there's all sorts of philosophies, belief systems that have made us, you know, religion, the Enlightenment, that justified that behavior, even the way the science of evolution was was interpreted, you know, survival of the fittest. These people were, you know, they're inferior races. They needed to be, they were on their way out anyway. So we've just speeded up the process in this civilizing mission. There were all sorts of psychological tricks that people played on themselves to justify this worldview. But I think with the extent now of the resource extraction and the decimation of our Earth's life support systems, with the interconnectedness of our planet, it's much, much harder to do that without seeing without actually being aware of the consequences. And I think people are waking up to that, but they're still trying to do this story that, we need to keep, you know, people have extra income, they'll put their children in a school that will give them the best opportunity to compete in this environment. Everything is hardwired now to continue this model where success looks like taking as much as you can really from everybody else and being a winner. And so implying these people are losers. And you can see that in the end game of this model, as nature just goes, no, I'm really sorry, this isn't working, is you've got 18 men, the billionaires, who own 62% of the world's wealth now. The last figures that I saw in an Oxfam report, that how on earth is that a success model when we know we have millions of people in absolute poverty, and you know, if you had that as a family and there was a brother upstairs in the penthouse who had this glut of stuff falling out of the windows and the rest of the family were in the basement shivering with cold and starving, would you call that a successful family? And their work, but they have to pay the rent to the brother upstairs. That's how he's got all his stuff. You'd say, God Lord, this is entirely dysfunctional. And in simple terms, that's what's happening on our planet. But people are so desperate to be the brother upstairs. You know, they're going to step on everybody who's down in that basement so they can get upstairs rather than see. And eventually the house will fall because there's the people in the basement, you know, the structure's wobbling. The thing, it just does not sustain itself. And that's where we are now. And so it's just, we have to now recognize that and try the model is, if we help each other, if we're this anchor ecosystem species where we enable everything to flourish around us, it might not be that we're up in the penthouse with all this glut of stuff falling out the window, but who's happy? We've got more psychosis, more opioid crisis. The peak happiness in America when they, I don't know quite how they measured it, was around 1952, post-war, when people came out of, you know, some degree of scarcity, or they felt that, and they had things like, you know, labor-saving devices that made their lives that little bit easier. But then after that, you pile on the bigger car, the bigger house, it just has not brought anybody happiness. So it is that understanding now that success isn't grabbing everything for yourself and, you know, having the biggest and the most high status. So it really is, you have to bring, it has to be collaborative. You have to have a healthy ecosystem all around you to survive. Otherwise you go in the end. You might be the last to go or among the thing, but you're still going to go. And I think that is, you know, the shift. So people essentially are good and they want a good life of themselves. But I think that the connection is we don't get it unless we build a system that is possible for all to flourish.
And in my experience, most people find out that is not it. You know, at some point, most people, not everybody, find out that happiness is not found in those things. It's actually found in the gorgeous relationships that we have with each other, in the gorgeous relationships we have sitting watching a sunrise, in the experience of humanity, being human, of being loved and held fondly, and those type of things. And so, which from my experience, it is a deeply shared human experience when we cut everything out and we go to that deathbed moment. I read a quote today. I think you probably appreciate this because you know that I'm very passionate about language. This is by Joseph. Colonized mind hears the word ours and hears possession. Decolonized minds hear the words ours and feel connection. Ours, O-U-R-S. And, you know, I wanted to raise that because the language, I'm doing a lot of sort of writing about this at the moment, but the language that we use creates our world. And the language of domination and exploitation and supremacy and superiority and righteousness is language of normal commerce. It's that finite, infinite game. It's the win-lose game versus the finite game. And one of the things that I'm passionate about in Centropic World is a principle called little atrocities, which I thought had come from Hannah Arendt's work. Hannah Arendt, the author of books like Eichmann in Jerusalem and how totalitarianism starts. I think her work is absolutely critical to this type of systems change, understanding how good people can do atrociously evil things. And so, you know, the little atrocities is when we step over our language and we talk about ours as ownership and possession, actually, more than anything, possession versus ours as connection. And just that completely different frame around that. But this goes into all forms of language. It goes into the language that we use. We've got to beat the enemy or win, or all of the military, even to the word.
Yeah. You use military terminology for your business strategy and dominate the market.
Yeah. And it is not going to create a more beautiful world. It's just not. It's the perpetuation of that. So this is the sort of dichotomy that lives in the holding changing systems at the highest level, all of the big systems that have us on this treadmill of Wetiko, but acting in the ground, you know, acting at the level of our language, our relationships, how we express to each other, that we start from the place of, I see you and I care for you and I respect you. Who are you? How can we create a space for you to bring your gorgeous multidimensional being into the world, into this project? How can we do that together? How do we not animate the language and the tools of domination and superiority? And I know this myself because, you know, I've been a passionate most of my life. I like being right. You know, I like being right. I think many people like being
most
right.
Most people like to be right.
Yes. But, you know, there's a reflect that when I'm right, I'm making somebody else wrong. And when I'm right, I'm also taking a position of domination. You know, there's that energy to that when we start to realize that it's so easy to re-inhabit and reanimate the very forces that we're seeking, you know, to have a world that doesn't do that. And so that's the sort of like the really grassroots practice that it's something that I'm really considering a lot at this point in time around the words of domination, superiority, supremacy, even in the untangling of the history. And I know that you have had that experience at the live level by nature of your who you are in the world and showing up as oftentimes the only Black woman in the room and stuff like that.
Well, I think it is, you know, it's so, if we're looking at you know, this being able to see other possibilities, the COP negotiations, we're coming up to COP29, there still isn't a seat at the table for Indigenous people. You know, we're on top. So this, you know, we're talking, the frame is, how do we move forward as a human family? You know, we would like to think that frame is, you know, we're on the shared planet. We're bringing 193 nations together to look at how to solve, you know, to solve the crisis of that's affecting the life support system of all of us. It has been hugely become more and more the fact that we're on COP29. You know, says a lot about the process. It's become very dominated by the, and people call it the oil and gas trade show now, But in all that time, there's still not a seat at the table for the indigenous people. 80% of the world's biodiversity is still in the territories that the indigenous people, the little that's been left to them. There's so much has been, you know, taken out in this colonization process. But these are ancient nations. They're nations that have been there for hundreds of thousands of years. A lot of the countries that sit at that table are new countries, you know, relatively new countries. And yet these people and people who have stewarded the land without injury for this long are not invited to the conversation about how do we steward our planet. And it's not really visible. In most people's minds, it's like, oh, yeah, well, you know, it's that the languaging of them, the tropes that have been put on them stick. You know, they're an underdeveloped people. You know, they might be picturesque, but they, you know, come on, they live in the forest. You know, what are they going to know about the real business of running a planet? And that is shot through because they've asked for a seat at the table. They've asked. And there's many different nations of indigenous people. I'm not just talking about Amazonian people who are hugely important. There's indigenous people, you know, right across our planet from Iceland all the way through to Australia. And they've asked for a seat at the table, but they're not being granted it because the people who hold power are saying, you know, your voices, essentially they're saying your voices are not as relevant as Shell or BP or the oil companies that are sponsoring the, you know, or having such a huge voice in the, or any other nation that may have been formed out of the removal of these people's territories. But that's invisible to most people. They're, oh yeah, well, you know, we've got more important things to think about. But you're really excluding the people who are living syntropically and have done so for millennia.
It when you speak about it like that, it draws this level of arrogance and, well, cruelty, marginalization, dismissal. It's terrifying to hear that is still the solution, which means it comes back to people like us, Cindy. We cannot expect the change to come. This is where I landed in my life. It's like I'm either going to be part of creating something in my language, you know, don't try and change, which is Bucky Fuller, don't try and change the current system, build new models that make the existing obsolete. Or in another way of saying that, let's not keep rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Let's build a new boat. And so building the new boat, because the people that go to COP and the people that are invested in keeping the Molokian wet ecosystem alive, I'm not going to do it. So it's going to be up to us. It is, you know, it is up to us to do it.
there's the paradox though, and there's quite a few people have articulated this much better than I'm probably going to be able to do this. But even when they're seeing I can't remember the name of the historian who wrote quite a bit about Australia. Is it Reynolds? His last name's Reynolds, but he's saying that he's written a book called The Other Side of the Frontier. And it's the same in, you know, the principle extends across that you're seeing two almost incompatible systems because one makes the other not possible. The system that is based on taking as much as, you know, individual possession and taking as much as you can for yourself is not compatible with a system that's about these are shared resources, let's cooperate. And that's the difficulty, is these two worlds that one almost by nature of its design is incompatible. That worldview is almost incompatible with any other worldview because it is about taking, you know, the strongest will take the most, no matter how we try to dress that up with our pseudo democracies. You know, you've got outright invaders and dictators, which, you know, the empires, but now, you know, we've kind of softened the edges a little, or at least for the surface. But it's still really about dominating control of resources to get the most power. And that's really incompatible with a worldview that's saying, hey, we need to we need to collaborate and we need to cooperate. We need to share. So that's the, I mean, I kind of brought that in quite follow from what you, but that's the hardest part of that, of this work, is telling these different stories in a way that are compelling. I know we just have to do what we can in our own, you know, in our own days, in our own life. But that is the hard part, when the current force is so powerful, and it is this is the model that we're following, and the rest of you are going to be marginalized or silenced. You know, look at the climate protesters, they're taking away so many of their freedoms to actually criticize this system. So that's tricky, you know, because it has to, the shift has to come in that space for any other model to have the room to come to life in a much more full way.
Yeah, I'm going to say at this point that in Centropic world work, we do a lot of work around polarity. Unity is plural at minimum two. We need that polarity, the yin and yang, the up to down, centropy, entropy, which enables existence. But when one polar charge goes to an extreme, so when we have too much negativity, too much hate, too much violence, too much greed, too much exploitation, any of that sort of thing, it gets to a point where it has to explode. Similarly, on the other side of that is when everyone's too nice or too sweet, and there is too much consensus, and there's not enough diversity, and there's not enough robust debate, and there's not enough of that beautiful creativity that comes when people really care passionately about something, that they'll be fierce, but they'll be fierce collectively, not fiercely attacking each other. They'll be fierce for a higher purpose. That at the moment, I see that this, the tension on the side of exploitation and corruption and marginalization and so on is amplified so much that there has to be a release point. I don't know what that looks like, and it's I hope it doesn't do too much damage, but there has to be a release point. We have to have examples, which clearly the Indigenous communities had examples, but this is not a story about going back to that. It's a story about it's a story about the integration of what has been good through a Western society. I definitely want my anesthetic if I have surgery. Thank you very much. And I'd like the specialist to be there if I have, you know, a heart disease or whatever. But we need, so it's an integration form of that. But we need, I believe, and this is my work, you know, we need to have models that are working and operating, that are demonstrating that there is another way of doing and being. And it's sort of this, you know, where people like Kate Raworth and her beautiful work, and many of the women around the world in the economic sphere are really pushing the envelope on this is the future that we can see and is possible. And so I think, you know, from my point of view, it's that twofold piece of having people first see the water that we're in, but secondly, also demonstrating that here's a way that it can be, that is a full integration of how nature works with the beautiful ingenuity of the West around technology and health and things like that, where the central purpose is that we hold life as sacred no matter what we do. So I'm holding that vision. And, you know, I believe that people like you and the work that you're doing is, and so many others, but are contributing to that vision. And the more that we can come together and work together in a very centropic way, which is, you know, towards a higher order in a way that holds the magnificence of each of us in our agency, but working collectively. So that's how do we coordinate people to create.
Which is what's so fantastic about what you're doing, because you're literally reaching across the planet with Zoom. It's with the technology. It's so possible now, and bringing together.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I get asked such, how do you work? I don't, the word sustainability to me is so out of date, really, but you know, but how do you work on sustainability? it's so depressing, but it's the absolute opposite, because you work with the people who are at this real innovative space in humanity, who are designing these new models, or who are really, you know, whose purpose is to find the new ways. So it can be daunting because of the challenge that we've just been speaking to, but it can also be exhilarating because you can actually, you work with people who can see the world differently, who are designing new models. And it is, you're right, Christine, it's so important to have those, to have that happening, because you can see, even though this model is can feel all consuming, there is this, you know, there's evidence of the, and the people, I know the people who work in this space are much more content, fulfilled, happier. They have a purpose that illuminates their life, our lives, rather than this thing, I need to get more. I mean, put in the crudest terms, you do find, I think, a higher level, you know, I'd say people are more evolved in their thinking. They're much more able to grasp these concepts, and they do have, you know, some people are, you know, are fine materially. Some people have less materially, but the actual levels of contentment and fulfillment in life, you can see are much, much higher.
Yeah, it is. That's my privilege, which is extraordinary. I get to hang around with amazing people who are wholehearted and incredibly creative and very dedicated and very committed to a world with a future for Earth and all her creatures. And I am just so privileged to have you in my life as a friend. And thank you so much for making the time to join us on this journey. And I am absolutely so excited about your book that's coming out, I don't know when, but in some time coming out. And so thank you, Cindy.
And thank you, Christine. I think I say it to you sometimes, but thank you so much for shining your light in this world.
This episode is produced by Foundation Nova Diem. We thank them for their wonderful production. If you are curious to learn more about Syntropic World, then please visit syntropic.world and sign up for our weekly Sunday Syntropy, where you will receive articles, tools, and resources to support your Syntropic journey. You can also find us on all the socials at Syntropic World. We love questions. Please ask. You can email us at hello@syntropic.world. Let's leave everything better and be Syntropic. Thank you for listening.